Training on the weapon took 2 weeks. Isa showed me everything there is to know about how to handle a gun. He also taught me how to shoot correctly.
What are the Olympic Games compared to the cause of the Palestinians?
When I arrived in Munich with my friend, I met Isa in the station restaurant.
The Fedayeens in the Black September organization are grouped into teams of 3 fighters each. At this time, it was our group's turn.
I remember arriving in Munich on September 2nd, 1972, around 6 o'clock.
The terror recruits traveled to Munich in different ways, just shortly before the attack took place. They had a few days in Munich to get used to each other. This was the beginning of the last step in a bigger plan that had started over a year earlier in the Middle East, about which the Palestinians had decided at the very top of their hierarchy, which brought the mastermind Abu Daoud to travel to Germany, who then brought the officers Issa and Tony with him, the two men who had recruited the team members in Shatila, Beirut and elsewhere, who trained them in shooting with the Kalashnikov, who sent them traveling to Munich and picked them up at the agreed meeting points. 3 of these recruits survived the attack. They were the only survivors. German police arrested them. They were taken into remand and spent some weeks in Bavarian prisons. Then they were released and set free. You might think, what? Freed? Completely set free? No prosecution, no court trial, no verdict. Never happened anything like that. Right, that's it. As a matter of fact, it is so weird that we are going to tell you about it in detail in upcoming episodes. But today we are talking about the arrivals of the terrorists in Munich, their last days and hours before the attack. My sources, the interrogation protocols of the 3 surviving terrorists, investigation reports and secret services notes.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte.
Hochwey September mehr allein. Achadassar. Kulam Zahar.
Episode 5. München Hauptbahnhof.
File Notice. Personal Details. Abdullah Samer Mohamed. Born May 22, 1950 in Akko. Student. Alias Mahmoud Hossein. Born 1950 in Jerusalem. Alias Nadel Salem. Born 1948 in Nazareth. Real name Alchezi. First name Hussein.
One man, 4 names. To keep it easy, we will just use his alias Samer. This is also what is used in most of the files. Samer had been interrogated 3 times. Some of his statements were not consistent. He withdrew parts and added others. In the following, I'm going to use those who he kept until the end.
As a Fedayeen, I belonged to a group that was accommodated in Damascus. In my group, there was a comrade named Abu Alala. He's the one with whom I traveled to Munich. At that time, I was living at my parents' place in a big refugee camp with around 60,000 people altogether. Abu Alala was from the same camp. My group leader was Abu Hassan. Whenever he needed people for an operation, he selected them from these groups and acted as the coordinator.
Where did you receive your military training?
In several military camps in Syria.
What types of arms have you been trained on?
Multiple arms, for example, pistols, machine guns, cannons, and hand grenades.
How do you define cannons?
I have been trained with machine pistols and machine guns.
Do you have a rank?
No, the Fedayeen do not have ranks.
In late August, he finished his terrorist training. It was around 2 weeks before the attack against the Israeli Olympic team when Samer had been activated.
1 week before leaving for Tripolis in Libya, Abu Hassan called Abu Alala and me to come to his office. There was a guy named Issa. Abu Hassan introduced us and said Issa would be our leader in an operation in Munich. He did not say what this operation was about. Time and place for the operation were not mentioned. All he said was that we had to go to Latakia on August 23rd and take a ship for Tripolis in Libya.
Same day, August 23rd, also in Damascus. Issa and Tony are meeting their other recruit, Al-Dnawi, in a rented flat. We have introduced Al-Dnawi before in the second episode of this podcast. They handed him a passport, 50 Syrian lira, 50 US dollars, and 700 German marks. He remembered.
Issa and Tony only said that we were meeting in Munich and that I would receive all other information there.
But Al-Dnawi didn't travel to Germany immediately. He spent almost 1 week in a hotel room in Damascus. Unlike Samer and Abu Alala, these two went on their travels on the same day. But they took a very different route and a different transportation system.
Abu Hassan escorted us to the port of Latakia on August 23rd. He handed Abu Alala and me a ticket for the ship to Tripolis and a flight ticket from Tripolis to Rome each. He also gave us each 1,000 Syrian lira in US dollars. Issa was already on his way to Munich, but I don't know how he got there. I guess he was traveling by plane because he had to be in Munich faster than we did.
It's obvious that during these days, Issa and Tony have been commuting between Germany and Damascus. This was surprising even for the German police investigators when Al-Dnawi delivered his statement during the interrogation.
When did you see Issa and Tony for the last time in Damascus?
In Damascus, I met with both of them for the last time on August 23rd.
That's impossible, because Tony was in Munich in the beginning of August already. How do you come up with this claim?
You cannot be right. I have definitely met Tony in Damascus on August 23rd.
Chances are good that Al-Dnawi told the truth. And it seems as if the German investigators just couldn't imagine that the terrorists were able to fly back and forth between Germany and the Middle East. Compared to this, Samer's and Abu Alala's travel went very smoothly, at least the first leg.
I was traveling with Abu Alala on a passenger ship named Sudan. It took off on August 23rd, around 4 p.m. The shipping company was named Arabic Shipping Company. In Alexandria, in Egypt, we docked for the first time. The ship remained there for 2 days. Abu Alala and I went sightseeing in Alexandria, but slept on the ship. Later, we had another 12-hour stay in Benghazi, where we did not leave the ship.
Then, on August 29th, Al-Dnawi also started his trip to Germany. He departed from the airport of Damascus.
My plane left on August 29th, 1972, around 8 in the morning. It was a jet of the Eastern German Interflug airline. The plane was only half full. I didn't meet people I knew. Around 3.5 hours later, we were landing in Belgrade.
Right after landing, Al-Dnawi picks up his suitcase and enters a taxi. He's heading to the railway station.
I showed my US dollars to the driver and he took $10 for the ride. This was fairly much, but we couldn't communicate. After arriving at the railway station, I asked for a connection to Munich at the information desk. I was told that there would be a direct connection on the next morning, August 30th, 6 o'clock. I spent the night in a hotel nearby and paid 7 German marks for the stay.
The staff at the information desk also told Al-Dnawi that he should go to a travel office to buy a train ticket, which he did. He pays 40 German marks and again is told the train would depart next morning at 6. However, when he came to the station, he was not successful in finding it. He again asked for the right connection and is told that there was another train departing at 2 p.m. So this is the one he took. While at 2 p.m. on August 30th in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, the train with the terrorist Al-Dnawi rolls on, the Egyptian ship Sudan approaches the coastline near the Libyan capital of Tripolis. On board, his two terrorist comrades Samer and Abu Alala. This was barely a week before the Munich massacre. At 4 p.m., the Sudan docked in the harbor of Tripolis. Sameer and Abu Halala onboarded.
We spent the night in the Hotel Europe, I guess in a room on the third floor. We had a double room for the both of us. We had to stay the night in Tripolis because our flight tickets had been issued for a flight to Rome on August 31st. We were flying in a Boeing. I guess it was a 727. After landing in Rome, we immediately took a taxi for the train station. Around 5 p.m., our train to Munich departed. Then we arrived in Munich on September 1st at 6 o'clock in the morning.
At the same time, no one of the Israeli team in the Olympic Village in Munich had a clue of what was coming. There was, for example, Max Slavin, the youngest of the athletes. He was probably the one in the team with the best chances for a medal, maybe gold. At this point, I want to highlight something. It's not just that the Israelis at the time didn't know what the terrorists were planning. The families of the killed athletes to this day don't have a full picture of what happened behind the scenes 50 years ago. This is although they struggled and fought with the German authorities to release their files and be able to learn what happened. When I sat with Anki Spitzer in Israel, the wife of fencer Andrei Spitzer, we browsed through the material that I had acquired in the archives. And I was really perplexed when I found out that I had information she never heard before in all of these 50 years.
It came out in the new information that we just received very recently from Christoph Lemmer, that they came from Latakia, which is a port in Syria. They went on a boat called Sudan, and they went to Alexandria, from Alexandria to Tripolis, and there they were received in Libya, and they were trained in Libya. They were financed by Libya. They got their weapons from Libya, and also they got fake passports, which were made for them in Libya.
The fact that the Federal Republic of Germany to this day fails to deliver all of the details and the complete picture of what happened to the families of the killed athletes is remarkable. But maybe this is now changing. Just recently, Germany agreed in founding a historian's commission to collect all the material and make it accessible to the families. We have talked about these negotiations in our previously released special episode that we published on August 5th. September 1st, Friday. When Sameh and Abu Halala arrive in Munich, they know what to do next. Everything is planned and prepared.
When we departed from Latakia, we already knew where to go in Munich. Abu Hassan had told us that we were going to meet Issa in a restaurant in the train station. He told us how to get there, and we found it right away. Once you leave the platform, you're entering the main building. In it, you find the restaurant on the right-hand side. So we went there. We just drank a cup of coffee, and then we were waiting on the passage by the platforms next to the restaurant.
Then Issa shows up and welcomes his two recruits.
Issa led us to the Hotel Monarchia. We had money on our own. Me and my comrade each had around 800 German marks in our pockets. Issa left us without any jobs for the moment. When we went into the Hotel Monarchia, he told us that we would stay there only one night. Then he spoke to an elderly man at the reception desk in German. He wore glasses.
Then Sameh and Abu Halala have a break. They spend the next hours in the hotel room.
Around 5:30 or 6 p.m., Issa returned. He said that we would go to the Olympic Stadium. We left the hotel, and since we were hungry, we ate somewhere, I guess in the train station. Issa did not say a word about our operation, and we didn't ask. We knew that asking was forbidden, and we were not in a position to ask. We took the subway to the Olympic Stadium. Issa had bought the tickets for all of us. I remember that we passed 5 stations before we exited the train.
Visiting the Olympic Stadium was kind of leisure fun. They watched a game of the volleyball competition of the women, Japan versus Korea.
The Japanese won, 3-0.
On the way back to the hotel, they then passed the Olympic Village and had a view on site where the operation was planned. Until then, only the planners and leaders knew the place. Issa, Tony and Abu Daoud. Now, for the first time, Issa showed it to the recruits.
When the volleyball match was over, we took the same way back, which we took to get us to the venue. For the first time, Issa talked about details. He led us to a fence that was built around the Olympic village. He showed us a portal that we should climb over. He showed us a house in approximately 20 meters of distance on the right-hand side of the street. Issa said that this was the house in which the Israeli team resided with 26 persons. He said that we would invade this house on September 5th. We would enter through the back door because there would be less people there. Then we should take the 26 Israelis as hostages. There would be a demand to release 200 incarcerated Palestinians in Israel. Issa said that there were also two women on the Israeli team, but they were residing at another place. We did not ask how Issa knew all this, and he didn't tell us. He said the operation would be easy.
Then they took the subway, returned to the main station and the Hotel Monakia. Sameh and Abu Alala slept for a long time. Saturday, September 2nd. Sameh and Abu Alala woke up at around 10 a.m. At noon, the reception called and asked them to leave, since they only had the room for one night. The two check out. Abu Alala pays 63 euros for the night. They have breakfast. Then they return to the main station and hang around. That same morning, one of their other comrades had arrived there, Al-Znavi, who came by train from Belgrade.
After my train stopped in Munich, I went to a restaurant in the station. In the restaurant, there was a buffet where I could stand. I lined up to the self-service and picked half a chicken, salad, as well as a piece of cake and coffee. The cashier was sitting around a corner. All in all, it cost a bit under 10 German marks.
Al-Dnavi had a few hours to kill, just as Sameh and Abu Alala did. With the difference that Al-Dnavi had no clue where to go for the day. He had an appointment for the next day in Munich, but not for this day when he arrived. So he continues to kill some time.
Around noon, I left the main station and just walked around. I went into another restaurant, but I forgot what it's called and what I ate there. During the afternoon, I went on a walk around.
Probably just by coincidence, his path didn't cross the one of his comrades. When Al-Dnavi walked around through the main station area in Munich, Sameh and Abu Alala again met their leader in the Munich main station.
Around 3 o'clock, Issa arrived. Together, we went to a restaurant, but we didn't enter. We were sitting outside on a terrace and had a cup of coffee. Then we were searching for a new hotel. Obviously, Issa didn't have a place for us for the night until then. And after asking around in 4 or 5 hotels and not finding accommodation, we went to the Hotel Augsburg around 5 p.m. Issa led us on the second floor into room number 15, and he already had a key for this room.
They checked their new hotel room. Then Issa took the two, Sameh and Abu Alala, and they went to where? Of course, to the main station again.
There we met a man who Issa referred to as Tony. This Tony should also take part in our operation. I have never met him before. I don't know when or how he traveled to Germany. From the beginning, I felt that Tony and Issa knew each other very well and that they had a good relationship. They looked a bit familiar, but I don't know if they were brothers. To my understanding, Tony must have arrived in Germany before Issa did. And Tony was well-versed with Germany.
This evening, they again watched a match of the women's volleyball competition, this time Cuba versus Germany. Cuba won 3-0, while Al-Dnavi still did what he done all day, killing time, hour after hour.
It was 8 o'clock in the evening when I again entered a restaurant, again in the main station. I remember it being a fast food restaurant. I had a sausage and a little bread. Then I went to another restaurant, which was parted in two. In the first room, there was a cafe, and in the back room, there was a normal restaurant. I took a seat in the cafe part and was sitting there until 2 o'clock. Then I left and walked around until the morning came. I remained in the vicinity of the main station all the time. I didn't sleep. I didn't even try to find a room and a bed.
Why didn't you look for a room?
I don't know. At least I found a park bench somewhere and rested there for a while.
Meanwhile, his comrades passed the dormitory of the Israeli athletes for a second time when they returned after watching the volleyball match.
Saturday night, after the volleyball match, when we passed the Olympic Village, Issa told us that we should keep in mind that our target would be on the fourth floor. We then took the subway to the Marienplatz. From there, we went to the Hotel Augsburg. Abu Elala and I entered the hotel while Tony and Issa went on, and I don't know where they went.
Sunday, September 3rd, 2 days before the attack. Samia, Abu Elala and Tony had their breakfast together. Al-Dinawi had spent the whole night outside. They walked around as usual. And he walked towards the main station as usual. He enters a restaurant and has breakfast as well. Tony and Issa meet and separate from the recruits. Al-Dinawi finishes breakfast and goes back to walking around and killing time.
I was then again walking around in the area. Around 1 p.m. I went into the aforementioned restaurant for lunch. Then I spent the afternoon walking through the city and looking at the store windows. Around 5 p.m. I asked the man where I would find the station, which Issa had noted on my paper sheet as our meeting point. He pointed to a subway station. I remember there was a spacious plaza. When I went downstairs, there were also stores in the basement.
Do you know the difference between city railway and underground?
No, I don't know the difference.
However, Al-Dinawi now strictly follows the plan.
I passed 5 stations when the man told me that I had to leave here, and I did. I don't know whether it was the terminus station or not. When I left the train and went up the stairs, I already saw Tony and Issa standing there. We greeted each other and I told them that I had already arrived one day earlier. Together, we left the subway station.
Up until now, Al-Dinawi was not aware that he was riding to the Olympic Stadium, but now he learned. Issa and Tony showed him the place. Then they returned to the subway station. They took a train to go, where? Right, to the Munich main station. They collected Al-Dinawi's luggage, went up to the hotel, and he could freshen up.
Then we three went to the main station. In the restaurant, we met Tony and 3 other Arabs. I think some minutes later, an 8th man joined us. Issa then welcomed all of us, one after the other.
This is how Al-Dinawi remembered the first meeting of the now completed terror squad team. And now, how Samir described this meeting. Allegedly, this was the first time that Samir and Al-Dinawi met, at least knowingly.
When we returned to the central station, we saw Tony, Issa and 4 other men sitting together. They were eating, and Issa introduced these newly arrived 4 men to us.
Now it's starting to heat up. Tony and Issa failed to acquire another hotel room. Munich is booked up during the Olympic Games. 2 of the newly arrived are extremely tired. They lay down in the beds of one of the hotel rooms at the Hotel Augsburg, where Tony also slept. Next morning, the roommate complains. She claims it being inappropriate that 3 men were sleeping in the same room. Issa solves the problem. He pays another 150 marks on top of the hotel bill. Then the entire group heads off to the main station.
We were all sitting together and had coffee. Issa then asked if we would like to watch a soccer game in the Olympic Stadium. He said it was Russia versus Morocco. We all appreciated that. By subway, we went to the Olympic Stadium. When we arrived, it had already gone dark. The game had already begun. The lights were switched on. We had seats. Russia won 3-0. After the game, we went into a bar. We were drinking beer, 1 can, each of us. Then we walked across the Olympic premises. That's when we came to the houses that Issa and Tony explained to us had all the delegations accommodated. They showed us a fence that separated the areas around the houses. Nothing more spoken as this.
Monday, September 4th, the day before the attack against the Israeli team.
On Monday at noon, we all went to the central station together for breakfast. Tony and Issa were with us. But these 2 went away because they had something to do. Later on, I went to my room with Tony, and there were 3 black suitcases, one of them a bit smaller than the others. All 3 were decorated with a slim stripe of aluminium. I hadn't seen these cases before. I asked Tony what they were for, and he said they contained weapons. He and Issa had acquired them when we had breakfast in the central station. Tony did not mention from where they had the cases, and I didn't ask.
At the same time in the Netherlands, Israeli fencer André Spitzer, just married to the young Dutch lady Anki, father of a newborn daughter, had taken the opportunity to escape from Munich for a short visit at Anki's parents, who took care of the baby. He was in a hurry, back to Munich, for being there on time when the Olympic Games came to their end and the plane would be ready to fly back to Israel. Anki drove him to the Amsterdam railway station. They were too late. The train was gone. Anki takes the driver's seat of the car and floors it.
So I drove 30 kilometers like madman. I drove to the next train station. I just put the car in front of the station. We ran inside. He didn't have a ticket. And the train was still standing in the station. And then 50 years ago, you could pull the doors and then still get in. Today, that's impossible. So we pulled the doors and the train started already riding. So he jumped in and I ran next to the train, and through the window he said, "I will call you when I get to the Olympic Village."
The last time Anki and André see each other. Back to Munich, same time. Final meeting of the terrorists.
I saw the weapons for the first time when the others returned with sports bags and when they were given to us. It was around 10:30 p.m. when we received the weapons.
Issa then sent Alalala shopping. 4 kilograms of peaches, 4 kilograms of bananas, and 3 cartons of cigarettes. All of the terrorists were smokers. The others should lay down and have a rest. Planned start time for the operation, 3 a.m.
Darwish and I couldn't sleep. We stayed awake. Around 11 p.m., I had to ask our comrades from room number 15 to join us in room number 12. Issa and Tony opened the 3 suitcases. There were 8 machine guns and 10 hand grenades in there. The guns were wrapped in clothes. It was all wrapped in yellow cotton clothes. The grenades were of American origin and the guns of Russian. For each of the guns, there was a double magazine consisting of 2 magazines strapped together. Each of these magazines should hold 30 bullets, and I counted them, and I found out that 1 or 2 were missing. This was the case with all of the magazines. Each of us received 1 machine gun, 1 double magazine, and 1 hand grenade. Also, each of us received cigarettes and fruits. They delivered the sports bags to us, for each of us a white Puma bag. Everyone then took clothes from his personal luggage and wrapped the guns in the clothes. I took 2 pants and 2 shirts.
Then the readily packed sports bags had been put into the suitcases. Tony, Issa and the third man carried them away. He didn't know where, Samir said. All men had to hand over their passports to the leaders. When they returned, briefing in the hotel room, Issa presented a sheet of paper with a sketch on it.
We should split in 2 groups and take taxis to the Olympic premises. Each group should walk to a place that was marked with the number 1 on the sketch. At this place, there was a tree. The first group should be led by Tony. To his group belonged Ahmad, Hussam and Afif. All of the others were under Issa's command. These 2 groups should climb over the fence one after the other and go to the building's back door, the house where the Israelis were residing. He said that we had to go into the room at the right-hand side. He furthermore said that we shouldn't be nervous and shoot only when urgently necessary. He didn't say more than that. After the briefing, we all came together at 1 o'clock. We went to the main station and were eating. Around 2 o'clock, we went back to the Hotel Augsburg. And around 2:30, the first group, which was Tony's, left the hotel. The second followed 10 minutes later. We called a taxi and Issa told the driver where to go. I didn't understand because it was in German. We drove to the Olympic premises, but not to the building. We had to walk to the place where we should climb over the fence, which took us about 15 minutes. And Issa knew where to go.
What follows is a terrorist crime of historic dimension, including an epic fail of police and state. We are able to reconstruct the attack that started early in the morning of September 5th, 1972, and ended early in the morning of September 6th, almost minute by minute. And we are meeting 2 brave police women whose role was highly underestimated over all these 50 years by historians and journalists who reported about this terrorist attack. We are going to correct this within the next episodes that reconstruct the day of the attack. And we are going to break the rules usually applied to podcasts. We are going to publish 3 episodes for this day, a nearly minute-by-minute reconstruction of real time plus 50 years. The first of these 3 at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Geheimakte 1972, 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.